So welcome again to the session of Innovative Strategies in Using Social Media and Technology in Public Health. As Soprana said, my name is Fred Grant, and I'll be presenting on low birth weight baby occurrences and can texting have an impact. And as indicated, I am a paid employee of the Northrop Grumman Corporation. What I'm going to try to do in the next 20 minutes is take some research that I've performed over the last year and condense it in a way that it might be valuable to you at some future time in terms of putting together a grant proposal or a paper or research that would help show the effectiveness of this new social media texting. Social media, specifically SMS texting, represents an innovation in the traditional community engagement programs. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to review the evidence supporting the effectiveness of SMS texting, and I'm going to seek to answer the question, what are the evidence-based arguments to establish the case for using this as an intervention, specifically connecting teens to information and community services? Also, I'm going to review low birth weight baby occurrences and their primary cause, because I want to establish clearly what the public health problem is that we could address using this new powerful media that we've got access to. I'm going to talk also about improved utilization of available community services, because texting needs to find its place alongside traditional methods of intervention. So some quick facts about low birth weight babies that you may or may not be aware of. Low birth weight is defined as a weight at birth of less than 2,500 grams or 5.5 pounds. And as you can see on the slide, babies born with low birth weight are quite small. They will literally fit in the palm of your hand. The number of babies born in the United States on an annual basis exceeds 336,000, and the percentage born roughly on an annual basis ranges from 8.2 to 9%, depending upon what year you're talking about and who you read. And also, it's worth noting that there is a classification called very low birth weight babies, and that represents babies that weigh less than 1,500 grams. So the percent born preterm, I've shown that on the slide because there is a very high correlation between preterm births and low birth weight, and our percent born preterm in the United States is actually quite high compared to the remainder of the world. It is 12.2%. So speaking of the world, the United States, and what really draws attention to low birth weight as a problem, is the United States ranks 27th among 33 industrialized nations in low birth weight. And we also rank 32nd among 33 industrialized nations for infant mortality. And I attended Dr. Frieden's grand rounds about 2 weeks ago on infant mortality. And while the latest figures have improved somewhat, and now I believe we rank 29th out of 33 industrialized nations for infant mortality, he indicated that infant mortality was the single largest public health predictor of the state of health for a nation. And so it's a very significant thing. If you look at where we stand in the world along a continuum, you'll see that more developed countries average low birth weight percentages of roughly 7%, and then the least developed countries of the world go to 18.6%. And of course, if you decompose or break down these statistics, you'll see that there is tremendous disparity among ethnic and racial lines. And in particular, black non-Hispanic race ethnicity ranks very high in the United States at 13.2%. So where I live in Georgia, I live and work there, if you look at it, Georgia has a problem that's also quite high. We rank 45th out of 50 states, And in part, in our state, teen pregnancies are a real problem. But that's not the only thing. If you look at Georgia in comparison to really all of the 13 southern states, you can see that a preponderance of low birth weight, infant mortality, and teen pregnancies occurs in our southern region. So the causes for low birth weight are numerous, and if you look really on your left-hand side, you'll see that poor nutrition, smoking, alcohol, drugs, stress, maternal diseases and infections are among the most common causes. And then there's other causes that are less preventable, including placental malfunctions, birth defects, fetal infections, problems with the uterus or cervix, structural problems, really, female anatomy, and, of course, multiple pregnancies. So if you look at public health, we know that our interventions work, and they work well. But what we need in terms of attacking the low birth weight baby occurrence problem in the United States is really a new intervention approach, particularly as it relates to teens and teen pregnancies. We know that low birth weight occurrences are largely preventable. They represent really an expensive problem. Preterm births, it's estimated, cost the United States over $26 billion a year. And if you look at the flip side of that, every healthy birth that occurs actually saves about $60,000 in the first year. So annually, low birth weight accounts for about 10% of all pediatric medical costs in the United States, and that is about $5.5 to $6 billion in healthcare and special education. So it goes without saying, though, that when you look at teen pregnancy specifically, the exact saving figures for teen pregnancy are unknown. But estimates can reliably be made that will place this problem in millions of dollars for each affected individual. So in terms of framing a problem statement, a public health problem statement that would go into a grant application or that would enable us to structure an intervention, our problem statement should include these things: that most low birth weight babies are born prematurely, that the earlier a baby is born, the less likely they are to have adequate weight, that teenage mothers are more likely to have low birth weight babies, and the risk is highest. Data shows that the risk is highest among mothers under age 15. So looking at 2005 data, we know that 16.4 out of every 1,000 babies of women under 15 died, and that's compared to 6.8% of per 1,000 of women of all ages. So you can see infant mortality is quite high among teen low birth weight baby occurrences. The risk for younger mothers as compared to older mothers is significant, as shown in the last bullet of the slide. So basically, where we stand is that low birth weight babies experience, not only do they experience higher mortality, but we haven't even talked about the morbidity that is lifelong associated with these infants. The lifelong part goes to things like learning disabilities, the potential for chronic disease, and the impacts are just not to babies. The impacts are really to the family unit and the caregivers, and the ongoing consequence that teen mothers will have to care for their child. They may have future pregnancy problems. They may have limitations in what they can do socially and economically in terms of their participation after the birth of a low birth weight baby. So the case that we would build would basically indicate that failure to take action on this public health problem will add millions of dollars, not only to state public health budgets, but to our national healthcare expenditure picture as well. So evidence has identified that social media approaches hold promise for reducing low birth weight rates, especially among vulnerable populations. So let's see what our evidence base really consists of. Okay, there's three things that we can draw upon that are, I think, absolutely essential in building a case. If you look at the public health reports, August-September of last year, volume 126, supplement 3, you'll see that that focuses specifically on data systems and their use in addressing social determinants of health. So obviously, we want to address the social determinants of health, and we want to connect what we're doing to the available peer-reviewed research in order to be able to structure a grant application that would make sense and obtain funding. The second thing that we need to do is we've got to connect to behavioral and social theory. And so social ecological theory, of course, is out there, and we know that we can place the individual within many contexts and that the use of texting and social media is effective within these different contexts. And then lastly, there's specific peer-reviewed literature, and that's what I'm going to concentrate on really for the remainder of my discussion. And I'm not really going to go over the evidence for text for baby or text to quit because you can find that very readily online. What I'm going to do is I'm going to draw upon what I call some seminal reports that actually do meta-analysis or major research of literatures. And by presenting this to you here, I think you'll see that there's lots of literature that can be drawn upon to help build a peer review evidence-based case. So you may not be aware of this, but texting actually is not an invention of the United States. It was actually invented in Great Britain, and in Europe and Japan and some parts of Asia and elsewhere throughout the world actually had adopted cell phone use significantly before the United States did. So the problem was in Europe in the 1980s, you had these cell phones that were now being introduced, and there was unused bandwidth during the times that the phones were not in use. And so someone came up with the idea that what you could do is you could use short messages during periods of inactivity on these cellular networks, and you could comprise short message services, as what it came to be known in Europe. And so SMS texts were designed to be small, concise little messages that could be sent very quickly, and they could be interspersed within the packets of other data that was going out on the communications network. The first real message that was sent in the United Kingdom was in 1992, and it was the text message, "Merry Christmas." So obviously, since 1992, we've come a long way, and cell phone use has evolved very significantly. I raised two boys, and believe me, my youngest is still 19, and when I, even sitting at the dinner table sometimes, he'll be trying to text away while I'm trying to take his texting away from him so he will engage with us. But approximately, if you look at 2010 data based upon the Pew Foundation research, we know that in 2010, there were about 2.2 trillion text messages being sent. And we also know that 91% of United States adults in 2010 subscribed to a mobile service. So obviously, you know, we are in the mainstream of this phenomenon, and we need to understand what it is, and we need to be able to harness it so that we can use it in public health. Okay. Also, you'll see that 80% of patients reported texting regularly, and that's on the low-income Medicaid group. And African Americans and Latinos are accessing the internet with handheld devices because they're more affordable and they're cheaper than personal computers. So you definitely want to look at the Pew Internet American Life Project. Because what it does is it establishes the case that more than half of teens send 50 or more text messages a day. And that teen girls specifically, 14 to 17 years of age, average 100 messages a day. And the conclusion overall of the Pew American Life Project is that text messaging has become the primary way for teens to stay in touch. And it surpasses face-to-face communication and email and other forms of messaging. It is the go-to media for daily communication among teens. Three other studies, and I'll mention very quickly, and I won't go through the details of them, but again, very significant bodies of literature because they, while they have their own findings, they do a very substantial and extensive literature review in their own rights. The Kaiser Family Foundation, they conducted a series of studies. They basically collaborated or triangulated the evidence of the Pew Foundation. Also, Cole, Lewis, and Kershaw, they specifically summarized data from 17 articles, 5 focused on disease prevention and 7 focused on disease management. And their conclusion was that text messaging could be used as a way to deliver prevention components based upon theoretical models that are already established in public health. And then lastly, we've got Preston, Wall, Horton, and O'Sullivan, and their conclusion was that the most effective and efficient means to influence patient behavior has been and will continue to be an ongoing area of research because their review of the literature was inconclusive in terms of being able to use this mechanism to shape behavior. So other things that you should examine, and again, I'll be very brief because I don't want to overrun my time, but the Health and Human Services Task Force, Text for Health, conducted an extensive literature review. And in that, their conclusion was that mobile phones and other portable health information technologies offer an unprecedented opportunity to improve health in the United States population and to reach low-income groups and ethnic minorities. And then, of course, another very powerful collection of research is the CDC's Social Media Toolkit. Again, they contain a literature review, and you can go down through, and they give guidelines, and I believe they summarize some excellent best practices in terms of the evidence-based approaches that we could draw upon. So, in conclusion, what I'll say is that evidence-based public health is something that is part of our practice. And so there is ample and adequate evidence that we can draw upon texting, particularly SMS texting, to be a part of the interventions that we're constructing, particularly with regard to teens. It does represent a new paradigm, but it also evidence indicates and informs us that texting improves the availability of information, and it also is seen as evidence, or it is seen as a mechanism that will inspire the confidence and trust of the message recipients. So, cell phone affordability continues to expand worldwide. Mobile technology will be embraced as a means to promote healthy behaviors, and we in the United States need to position ourselves to be in the mainstream of these developments. Areas for texting, future research include affecting prenatal care, affecting nutrition, affecting smoking, but moreover, it's also going to the nature of our community interventions that we're doing. How can we better partner? What technology platforms will be more effective? How can we build more effective collations? And moreover, what evaluation methods should we use to truly know how to improve these programs so that they can have more of an impact? The references that I have are available to you. I'd like to acknowledge two people, Moose Alperin, of the Rollins School of Public Health in Atlanta, Georgia, and Pam Gadsden, the Executive Director of Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies Coalition of Georgia. That's my timer. And I'm on time. So Aunt Pam Gadsden, the executive director of Healthy Mothers, Healthy Baby Coalition of Georgia, both of them were peer reviewers of the research that I conducted. Because I have another speaking engagement, I will not be present for questions today during this session. However, please write me if you do have any questions about the presentation. And moreover, I will provide to you my research that I've done, free of charge, no strings attached. I have what would also be a grant template that presents a case for teen pregnancy, low birth weight, tying it to texting, and that is part of the packet that you would receive from me upon request. It's been a great pleasure to speak with you today, and I'd like to thank you very much for your time and attention.